Welcome to Compliance Therapy with Igor Volovich, presented by Cumulos. Cumulos, converged continuous compliance. Get it together.
Today, we're honored to welcome to the program a man who needs no introduction, a recognized thought leader, a respected industry analyst, an experienced technologist and executive, a veteran, and an all-around great guy, Dr. Zero Trust, or as his friends call him, Chase Cunningham. Dr. Zero Trust, you are now in session with Compliance Therapy. Welcome.
Well, thanks for the kind intro, and B, this is interesting because, you know, usually the therapy I'm in involves a couch and someone telling me I need to do better. So,
well, that's what we can talk about. So, I mean, we have two doctors in the building right now, so I don't know who's on whose couch. Very cool. Well, thanks for making the time for us. Welcome to the program. It's great to have you. It's great to catch up. Of course, you and I go back many years. I think back to Mach 37, I think is where we first met.
That's right. We both have battle scars from Mach 37.
That's right. That's right. And of course, you want to tell folks what Mach 37 was in your life?
Yeah. So Mach 37 was a tech accelerator that myself and my good friend Heather Dahl got involved in. We had built an application for kids and families to do encrypted security stuff. And it was a great learning experience, but it didn't unfortunately wind up making us into ultra billionaires. So, you know, it was an exercise in learning, if nothing else.
That's what Mach 37 was about. Take folks from the paper napkin to their first PO, hopefully, or at least get them to work through the problem set. That's very cool. So how does a Navy crypto chief go from that to helping secure kids?
My whole life and career, I've just been lucky to be blessed by being around, you know, way smarter, more capable people. And at every turn, seems like I've been introduced to new opportunities. We created the Sinja comic to kind of keep kids engaged in cyber, which did really well. It was in four languages, and we had kids sending us pictures of their Sinja birthdays. We got the Comic-Con a few years in a row. And after that, we had parents at every Comic-Con come up and saying, is there an app for Sinja for our kids? And at the time we were like, no, there's not. And then Heather said, well, we should just make one. So we did. And we put a bunch of proprietary encryption stuff behind the scenes that we built. And it was there. It was ran. My kids used it. We had some users, but you know, I think we were just ahead of the market, and it didn't take off the way that we hoped it would. If we'd have been, you know, 3 years ago, it'd be a different story. But this was back in, you know, 2015.
Yeah, something like that. Ahead of its time. Now, you guys, I remember, and I was one of the mentors at Mach 37. That's how we met. And I remember being very impressed. And also, it was a bit of a whiplash moment for me where I kind of did a double take. Wait a second, Chase Cunningham, with the background that you have, and Heather Dahl, the background that she had.
Right.
But you guys came together under the umbrella of basically storytelling. You figured out how to tell a story and reach a market. I mean, we're talking about kids and parents, not exactly a sophisticated buyer when it comes to cybersecurity, but you managed to figure it out.
Yeah, well, and that's one of those things where, again, I say, like, I'm not joking when I say, like, I'm lucky I'm surrounded by better, smarter people, because Heather was the one that put together all of that market material. She's the one that polished all of the decks and stuff. I was just there as the security wonk to make sure that things were put together the way that they needed to be, because we were going to have kids and parents' data in that whole thing. And it, like I say, it was great, because that was my, I would say, first real commercial gig after I retired. Because after I medically retired, I went to work for the government again. As a contractor. And then this was my first real tranche of go off and be an entrepreneur sort of, and, you know, build something for the market. And I learned a lot. I learned a lot of what to do and what not to do.
That is the point. I mean, you've got battle scars from battles, and you got battle scars from doing the startup experience.
Yeah. My bank account has got the battle scars from the commercial stuff. Yep.
Yeah, I know how that works. We've definitely, you know, being a part of the program, and I think I went through four cohorts altogether. And of course, Bob Stratton is the guy who brought me in, and he started the whole program, and we're still great friends, and we still collaborate a lot. And so I still hear about some of the cohort members and what they've gone on to do. And of course, we had some great hits and we've had some folks who just learned a lot. And that's also important. I think that's kind of the point of the program. But I'm glad that you and I got to meet and you got to experience that that program and learn a few things about how it works in the commercial space, which I think a lot of folks who I think start out their careers on your side of the world, you know, doing the military thing and being involved in the intelligence community, coming out of the fort, coming out of these programs that are very classified and kind of ensconced and maybe somewhat isolated from that outside environment, the commercial environment, understanding how things work from a product perspective, not just creating a great piece of technology, but also something that's sellable and how to tell that story. I think that's the common theme. And I was really impressed to see what you guys did back then with the storytelling around the concept. Because again, you got to sell it to the kids, you got to sell it to the parents. And that's not an easy sell. They're definitely inundated with a lot of messaging from serial to cybersecurity apparently now.
Yeah. It never ends. I mean, it's a real exercise. If you've never tried to polish a product to get it to the younger generation and families, it's a lot of work.
Very cool. Well, and I, as I understand, after that, you joined Forrester for a while.
I was at Forrester for 4-ish years. Great job. Amazing people. I really liked it because there it was very much almost, this sounds kind of counterintuitive, but it was very much reminded me of how it was in the military where they said, here's what you need to do and here's what we expect out of you and go. And they just let you go. And that was, for me, that was great because that's the way I prefer to get things done.
It's good to know what the mission is. So what sectors were you focusing on when you were at Forrester?
I started out just kind of general network security and security for specific sort of red team use case tied things. And very quickly, I was fortunate enough that they kind of said, look, this zero trust thing's been sitting around for a bit. Why don't you see what you could do with it? And, you know, again, to their credit, Forrester let me kind of run at that with my own approach. And we were able to modify ZT for a framework, and then the framework really hit and started doing some good things in the market.
That's amazing. It's great to have that freedom to innovate and really kind of spread your wings and really coin a new term and really build up a practice around zero trust within Forrester and kind of across the industry. And I know your voice is heard in many different corners of our space, and I know you're very respected, and what you say definitely carries a lot of weight. So zero trust, obviously, Dr. Zero Trust, tell us about how that came about. Of course, I know you've got your PhD in cybersecurity, but how did this come about?
Well, I mean, you know, everybody's got to have a thing. And I was like, well, if I'm going to be good at something, I'm just going to be good at this. So I kind of said, I'll just take ZT and make that part of my shtick. And then B, I was doing so much stuff with different organizations on ZT between advisory and consulting and guidance and go to market and all the ZT things. I was like, I jokingly said to somebody, you know, I should have a doctorate in zero trust. And they were like, well, just, you know, just be Dr. Zero Trust. So I just kind of said, okay, yeah, I'll do that. And then I grabbed it and went forward. And it's turned out to be a useful moniker. At least it's helped when folks look around for ZT, they, you know, typically will find something I've written or published or et cetera.
That's very cool. Easy to find and then definitely easy to read. I mean, at least if you know what you're reading, a lot of folks, of course. And you've made it very accessible. I think that's the point of zero trust, that folks get kind of get wrapped around the technology of it. And of course, the vendors are not helping with that because everybody who's anybody is putting zero trust on whatever they've got and trying to chase that bandwagon and jump on it and make it part of their branding, part of their messaging. It's become more of a marketing thing than anything else. And kind of the truth in advertising should definitely extend towards the cybersecurity market, but it hasn't. And I think that's where some of that credibility gap occurs between the market and the vendors. So speaking of vendors, where do you work now and what do you do and how does Zero Trust enter into your life today?
Yeah, so I mean, now I work for Ericom Software, and we've built a stack for small and mid-sized businesses because to me that was just a passion product of I wanted our capabilities to be priced and aimed at the market where it was likely to get the most impact, which is small and mid-sized business. And really, what we've done there was we've taken the capability sets around keeping users from interacting with malicious content, remote browser isolation, those types of things, segmentation, and then tying that into the ZTNA identity and access management stack. And being able to do that where, because we have no hardware, because we have, you know, a very malleable space and a very cloud enabled, you know, forward approach to the problem, we can offer that to small businesses at an extremely affordable price point. And when I say extremely affordable, I can do the whole stack for a small and mid-sized business for like $4 per user per month.
That's impressive. So you're actually making Zero Trust consumable as much as John Kindervag, the father of Zero Trust, your good friend and colleague, and other folks in the industry are saying, look, you can't really buy security. You're making Zero Trust actually accessible and consumable by folks who kind of need it the most.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the trends, and I mean, when I wrote my cyber warfare book, like I said in that book that the bad guys were going to go downstream, and that's exactly what's happened. And why? That's because big enterprise has been able to throw big money at the problem, and they've got the heft to do it. So if you're the bad guy, what do? You don't continue to beat your head up against a brick wall. You go, well, I'll go downstream because they're networked into you. And how do you do that? You do that with excessive privileges and accesses and VPNs and shared passwords and blah, blah, blah. And you do that from the small and mid-sized business. So it does, you know, in my opinion, it didn't make a lot of sense to continue to try and sell into big enterprise. I mean, obviously I can do things for big enterprise, but I just didn't see that opportunity was going to make a substantial difference for those that needed it most. And then on the far side was just a challenge for what we were doing. Can you do this and deliver it at a price point that is not cost prohibitive for that market? And it was a lot of another opportunity to learn. It was another opportunity to try different things and to modify the approach on the fly.
That's important. Well, and agility is something that smaller firms, of course, have that luxury, right? And I think when we were both doing startups, I think that's something that we learned very early on. Coming from large environments, you came from the Navy, I came from big companies like Microsoft and IBM and Schneider Electric, where I was a CISO. You can't turn the Titanic on a dime. You have to plan for these things, and these pivots are tough to come by, and they're very expensive. So somebody at a very high level has to take a lot of risk on personally as a leader to try to engineer that kind of a directional change. And the outcomes are not certain. You know, we know that more than half the mergers sometimes fail. And, although that statistic's been kind of challenged in the last few years, but still, even if it's half, it's still bad enough.
It's still significant,
Yeah. And so it's tough to do. And but smaller companies, they have that freedom, and the freedom to innovate, the freedom to pivot, the freedom to access the market in different ways. And I think what you're describing is that kind of freedom that it's tough to access for large enterprises as well, because they're looking for the big names. They're looking for the established players, you know, kind of the back in the day, they'd say nobody got fired for buying IBM.
Yeah.
And now nobody gets fired for buying, you know, Azure or AWS or Google Cloud. But there are other capabilities that folks need to be aware of. And we're seeing, of course, a lot of consolidation in the marketplace. And of course, from your seat as a Forrester analyst, of course, you saw a lot of that. And I'm sure you still maintain some visibility to it. But what are your thoughts about this particular problem? How do you make sure that innovation continues to be available, that you can take advantage of it as it arrives onto the marketplace? How do you maintain visibility to it as a large enterprise that needs these capabilities, but all they know about is, you know, the Microsoft, the AWS, the Google, et cetera, right? How do they fix that gap?
Yeah, I think number one is not to be married to that approach that I still run into this all the time of folks will go, where are you on the magic quadrant or where are you on the wave? And it's like, I tell them flat out, I'm not there. If you're looking for my product on a MQ right now, it ain't there. So if that's your point one of decision making, you know, go somewhere else. And it's not that those aren't valuable reports, but the point is, if you really are looking at innovative things and you're looking at big picture, you need to open your aperture, and you can't have that first line in the sand of, if it is not in an analyst report, I won't consider it. So my response to those folks would be, open up your aperture, think outside of that sort of box, and then, you know, consider other things. And then the other side is, you really should be leveraging virtual solutions that can let you test these things in place and do it in a simulated environment. If you're not doing that, you never know how it's going to work. You never know how it's actually going to, the biggest problem that everyone runs into is deployment and making sure that things configure. So why not do that in a virtual space? Because that's what it's built for. I mean, I'm a huge fan of the stuff that Craig Stevenson does at Hypercube, because you can build the whole virtual environment, demo all the stuff you want. And if it doesn't work, you just nuke the whole thing and move on about your day.
Yeah, that's definitely. I mean, emulation, attack simulation, you know, breach and attack simulation, that's an emerging marketplace now. We're seeing a lot of players in there. I happen to be on the advisory board of a company called R-Threat. I'm sure you know those guys.
I know R-Threat. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
They're doing great work. And I think actually John Kindervag has joined us on the advisory board there. I think a lot of that, the idea of what visibility means has kind of morphed over the years. You know, we used to do kind of that standard, let's do an asset inventory. It's very static. You know, we've got things in a data center. We can go and touch them if we wanted to. But these days, you know, yeah, you can take a ride to Ashburn and you can walk by the data center and maybe you can even get a pass to get in. What good does that do? Because the data is everywhere and it, you know, it belongs to you in terms of risk and responsibility and accountability, right? It lands squarely on that matrix for you. But in terms of where it actually sits, how you put your hands around it, that's changed completely. And so I think with it, so changed the idea of what does asset visibility mean? What does threat visibility mean? And how do you also understand the outcomes and predict them, not just from a perspective of a threat model and some kind of a theoretical formula of, you know, the annual loss expectancy and things like that, but can you actually predict the success of your program based on the tools and the technology and the strategy that you've selected? And that's not a rhetorical question. I am really posing it. I mean, and I don't know if there is an answer. Do you think there is one?
I mean, I think that the answer, I think, you know, the answer is the question, right? I mean, that sounds like a total cop-out answer, but it is to say that the way that you're doing it has to be focused on, you know, the bigger, broader problem set. And are you really applying things that will eliminate the adversary's advantages? I mean, I think that that's one of the things that we still don't wrap our head around very well in most security advisories that I've been working in, where folks are always looking for the perfection of defense and the, you know, how to not have a breach and how not to whatever. And we have 30 years of proof that that's not going to work. So in reality, looking at those things, whether they're devices or workloads or blah, blah, if you think about, okay, well, what does the bad guy have to be successful? And let me remove as much of that as possible. I'm just trying to make their job as an adversary hard enough that they'll go somewhere else. And it might suck for whoever else is next, but it ain't me.
That's the thing. You know, the analogy I used back in the day when I grew up in New York, and you'd go down the street, you know, back in the 90s, the big bad 90s, which I think I'm back now. But you walk down the street in New York at night and everybody had the club on their wheel in the car. And the ones that didn't have the club probably had a higher risk and definitely got their car stolen a lot more frequently. And it was really, you know, don't be an attractive target. Now, we do understand, and you and I both come from the backgrounds where we get it. You know, if somebody wants you, they'll go after you and they'll get you. So if you've got something that they want, they will go after you, especially nation state actors, folks like that, you know, dedicated adversaries. But a lot of the stuff is opportunistic. Don't be an easy victim, right? Let the other guy take the fall. And, you know, basic things like cyber hygiene and understanding that you can't buy your way out of a security problem. You can't just stack your stack very high and hope that complexity deters somebody. No, actually complexity works against you. You want fewer things to manage and better outcomes. And I think there's been insufficient focus on that. A lot of folks have kind of chased that technology, the latest, shiniest, brand new things, in the hopes that it would deter or it would significantly degrade the adversary's capabilities. And it just doesn't work that way. The complexity tends to work against you.
Yeah, I mean, that's where, for me, it always really occurs to me when I ask an organization, they say, well, you know, have we done a red team? And they'll say, well, we've done a pen test. And I say, that's not what I asked. Have we done a red team? Well, you know, we think that that would be detrimental to the sort of operation of business, blah, blah, blah. My question to them is, do you think it would be detrimental to the business if the bad guys owned you? Because that's what they're trying to do. And all for pen tests, they make sense. They're useful. However, if you don't put yourself in a posture where you're defending from the reality of a threat, which would be a red team type of activity, you never know what's going to happen. And the other benefit there is if you go through that exercise, a real exercise, you see where people fall or respond. You know, you talked about being in the Navy. Well, I remember very, very specifically the first time we did actual training in a building that was on fire, that was for training purposes, seeing people freak out that days before that had been talking about how they were so excited to go fight the fire and combat this and whatever else. The moment that it actually became on fire, they, you know, literally there were folks that turned around and ran. And it's like, this, I'd rather do this now than do this when we're out at to see when people's lives are actually on the line.
No substitute for the real thing, right?
I mean, you know, that's what you want. It's not comfortable and it's not easy. But that's change, you know, and I say this to my family, my kids, whatever, like any change you put in place that's significant, it's going to suck. So just deal with the suck and then move past it. And that's the reality of it. No, even if it's, you know, something very simple, like trying to get in shape. I mean, how many people become gym rats for the month of January and then they're done by February?
I think that's the entire business model for every gym ever.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds like that's pretty much how they approach the business. They make a lot of money that way.
Certainly do. They certainly do. Well, I'm curious what your thoughts are on this concept that I've been kicking around for a while and talking to a few folks in the industry, and I'll lay it out here with you. The idea of a time factor in how we think about security. You know, we talked about just now this idea of binary security. You know, we either secure or we're not, and it's not quite that way, right? There's grades of, you know, kind of shades of gray when it comes to that. And when we talk about mitigating threats, and you know, maybe the idea of a perimeter has gone away, but the threats still follow a certain pattern. You know, we can call it an attack pattern, or we can call it a kill chain. But you can certainly interrupt that kill chain, kind of like in aviation. The accident chain can be broken. You know, if you had done the weather briefing before you set off, you would know that there is a cumulus cloud coming down and you don't need to be in it, right? And you're not trained for that, or you're not ready for that, your equipment is not. You can break that chain before you ever get off the ground. And even when you're in flight, you can still turn around. There are plenty of opportunities. When you look at those accident reports, which I do because I enjoy understanding how things happen, right? You understand that failure mode and the effects analysis. And when it comes to security, we don't seem to spend enough time doing that. And also we seem to ignore the time factor, it seems. And the time factor being, can I predictively understand what an incident would look like, what a breach would look like, what a compromise would look like? And I think these are distinct terms, of course, as we know. But also, if I can understand it, what can I do about it? And understanding the limitations of my own program, how much can I actually exert a level of influence over these outcomes? And being very honest, very transparent, very credible when we have that conversation, I think I don't want to call it a lost art, because I don't think that's ever existed. I don't think we've ever taken that kind of a strategic approach as security leaders. I've seen very few programs who talk about it. I've seen zero programs that actually run that way. And I think it's because of the complexity, right?
Complexity's not your friend when you're trying to, you know, be in a defensive posture. And it's also, but I think a lot of times too, though, we sit on the far side of this. Cause I mean, I talk with a lot of CISOs all the time, and they're dealing with increasingly complex environments, increasingly moving, you know, increasingly dynamic moving targets, more cloud, more devices, more users, more accounts, more remote, more. And it's going to, the very nature of the way that we function means complexity is a given. So I think for us to really say how we solve this, it is leveraging solutions and capabilities, even if they're open source, but it's probably better to get a vendor one, but that do operate at that scale and with that capacity to do things as simplistic as possible without sort of negative user and negative infrastructure impacts. That's what they have to be. I think we I think we have a bad, and I've heard it a lot in the market lately, of saying like, well, you know, complexity is the enemy of good security. Yeah, it is. That's a fair statement. But I mean, we have to be real about this. You will be more complex. So be real about that and deal with it.
Do you suffer from seasonal compliance fatigue and chronic compliance headaches? You're not alone. Countless IT, compliance, and cybersecurity professionals just like you continue to suffer from legacy compliance, audit, and assessment workflows, excessive compliance paperwork, and manual evidence collection. Sadly, most have just accepted the idea that compliance management must always be difficult and unpleasant, but it doesn't have to be. Cumulos, an industry leader in converged continuous compliance, has developed revolutionary treatment options to relieve your compliance-related stress, delivering a fully automated end-to-end compliance experience. Don't delay. Call today for a free consultation with one of our compliance therapists and start your journey to converged continuous compliance by Cumulos. Call toll-free 1-844-476-8567 or visit cumulos.com to start your healing journey. That's Cumulos.com. Cumulos, the compliance automation you need, the compliance experience you'll love.
That makes perfect sense. Well, let's talk about this. How do you know if your program is actually doing well? And I don't mean how many times you got breached last week. A lot of us don't even know that. But let's say just as a CISO today, how would you measure performance?
Well, I think I would start with a measurement on how good my asset inventory is to begin with. So I know what I'm responsible for and what I have to defend. And there are good solutions that can tell you what is there, what you have currently sending electrons. And I think that for me is, okay, let's start with what do I have? So that's my baseline. And that's a metric I would use. And then the next thing that I would really use is boiling off all the bad account practices that are there. You know, do we see duplicate accounts? Do we see bad passwords? Do we see accounts without multi-factor, blah, 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 all those pieces. And I think that starting there would be a very good way to say, do I know what I'm responsible for? Yes. Do I know what the easy avenues of problem are? Yes. And am I burning those down? And I think I won't put their name out there, but I know someone who's a CISO at a huge organization that has said that that's been their approach, and they've seen really big return on that investment based on that model.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, as a former CISO myself, responsible for, you know, the entire Western Hemisphere for a company with, what, 180,000 folks at the time. And we had everything from, you know, Nestle candy bars to nuclear reactors in China, and we were doing control safety systems and automation systems. It's a big, big elephant, and you kind of want to try to eat it one bite at a time, but you do have to be cognizant of, well, the size of the elephant. You have to be realistic about that. And when you measure performance, I think folks struggle with that because, well, how do you do it? There is not a standard model for measuring performance. I mean, you can, and I spoke to a good friend of mine who's in the talent game, right? And she's an executive recruiter. And she said, you know, when I hire for a chief marketing officer, I know what kind of attributes I'm looking for. I know what to ask for. I know what to look for in the resume. Same thing for a CFO, CEO, really any other C-level role. But when it comes to CISO, we don't really have a good model. And the proof is in the pudding. CISOs keep changing jobs every 18 to 24 months. That statistic hasn't really changed. So clearly, we as an industry have a performance measurement problem, and we haven't really agreed on how to tell if we're doing a good job, other than, well, we're in the news or we're not.
Well, I mean, as a CISO, I think the thing for the CISO to remember, right, is you are the person treading through the minefield, whether whether they told you that or not, and whether you want to accept that you are. You're unfortunately the person that when things do go wrong, you know, they're looking for someone to point fingers at. It's going to be you. I have yet to see an organization that's had a major event where it hasn't been the CISO who is the first, you know, lamb to slaughter. And that's kind of why you have the opportunity to be a little bit more demanding about what you get when you take that job, because you're probably not going to be there for a whole lot of time. But then on the far side of that, as someone who's been offered a CISO role at a really significant organization that turned it down because the leadership wasn't willing to empower me, I think that there is a real need for personal accountability, that if you're going to take that job, you had better be willing to jump on that sword. And you should also take your time to make sure that that organization is going to give you what you need to be successful. Otherwise, you know, you're compromising your own personal integrity. And for some people, maybe that's okay. For me, it's not.
That makes sense. Well, you've built a career on credibility and integrity and being very honest and direct. And I think we can all appreciate that because your voice carries a lot of weight in the industry and it continues to do so. And those are the reasons why. Well, I wanted to talk to you, kind of segue from the conversation about performance measurement to this other idea where I know a lot of the programs that I've certainly been involved with or had a look into, they've reached for this kind of false comfort of compliance. They say, well, we can't really tell how well we're doing, so let's just do compliance. Let's pick a framework or a standard. And of course, there are standards and frameworks that a lot of folks have to comply with. Some of them are in regulated industries. Some of them are just, you know, they say, okay, let's pick ISO, let's pick NIST, let's pick FSMA. We have to do FSMA because we're federal or we are involved with federal environments as clients or suppliers. Let's just measure our performance by compliance. And What are your thoughts on that, just kind of generally, and then we'll kind of dive into that a little more.
I mean, compliance is good. Compliance is the bar. Compliance is a way for us to know that there is, you know, minimum achievement of things that are broadly accepted as a standard. So I think compliance is necessary, but I think that folks also will hit the compliance sort of threshold and say we're good, and that's not it. I mean, No bad guy that I've ever run into or adversary I've ever heard of said, oh my God, they're a compliant environment, we should stop. I mean, that if anything, might mean that it's a little bit more difficult and time consuming, but it also means that there's probably something there worth defending. So, you know, go at it with a little more fervor. I don't think that compliance should ever be a reason you just go, yep, and then sit with what you have. It's the floor, not the ceiling.
That's very well put, and I couldn't agree more. I think what I called it in an article I published years ago that was called Hackers Don't Care About Checkboxes, which is, I think, exactly what you just said. Hackers just don't, right? And you should think, if you want to think like an attacker, start there. Start to think about what they don't think about, which is checkboxes. They don't care about your checkboxes. And if all your compliance program is checking a lot of boxes, it's probably not going to get you anywhere. But I think there are a couple other things that are important to understand. And one is compliance is never perfect. And the first page of every audit report I've ever read is the scoping statement. Mm-hmm. We're talking about a subset of your environment that we're even going to attempt to put our arms around with our compliance measures. So you're already starting from a subset of your overall world. So here's the thing that's knowable, and then here's the thing we're only going to look at. It's like that old parable about the guy looking for his keys at night, and he's under a street light, and another guy comes around and says, what are you doing? He says, I'm looking for my keys. And goes, where'd you lose them? Oh, over there in a ditch. Well, why are you looking here? Because the light's better here.
Yeah.
The light's better here. And I think that a lot of compliance programs, I mean, by definition, you are looking at a subset of things, the assets that matter to a specific subset of your operations that are within the scope of that compliance regime. You're answering somebody's questions more often than not when you're doing compliance, not your own questions. So when those requirements come from without, not from within, you're subordinate to other folks' needs, not really the needs of your own enterprise. Do you agree with that?
Yeah. And I actually tell a story. I was going to buy a used truck, and I went and I looked at this truck, and the paint was good. The engine was good. It was, you know, nothing overtly wrong with it. And I was like, well, I want to see what's up with the undercarriage. And I got on the ground and crawled up underneath it. And sure enough, I mean, the cross members were so rusted. I literally took my finger and poked a hole in one of the cross members. And I came out of there and I went to the folks selling the car, and I was like, look, you know, number one, this is a safety issue. You can't sell this vehicle to folks like this, because if someone hits a pothole, the whole car is going to implode. So this is not okay. And then number two, you shouldn't be trying to sell this and say that it's a clean vehicle, because, you know, TrueCar or whatever doesn't say that it's got an issue. I mean, in reality, all you need to do is get a flashlight and look at the frame and there's a problem. And their response was, well, it passed inspection. And that just, to me, is a great example of folks saying, well, here's the floor. The floor says the blinkers work, the lights work, the brakes work, and the basic sort of overt safety issues are there. But they never go, well, what is the potential for a really bad thing to happen? We know how this thing operates. We know that it came from an area that's got salt on the road, so it's going to have rust. No one crawled up underneath it and said, oh my God, there's a 5-inch section of the frame that is so weak you could poke your finger through it.
I think that is a wonderful example, right? I think that's a perfect analogy for what we deal with a lot of times with compliance programs. They're not realistically capturing the state of the risk within the environment, starting with the fact that A, a lot of times they just don't look at enough. B, they're trying to answer a set of questions that are based on good intentions, right? I mean, look, let's roll it back a couple of steps. Compliance is not a bad idea.
No, it's good. And it's useful.
Go ahead.
I'm just saying it's you should be compliant. So I get lots of like dirty emails from people on LinkedIn and Twitter about like, I bashed compliance. No, for the record, compliance is good. It's useful, but it's not the ceiling. It's the floor.
You said it right. Yeah. I think the way that compliance has sort of diverged from security, where we functionally have started to consider it a separate division, separate idea, separate concept. And we have separate teams. You know, you've got your compliance teams that are run more like audit shops. And then you've got your security teams that are doing cool stuff, threat hunting and, you know, vulnerability management. And they're chasing threats and they're responding to incidents and it's cool. And they're pulling forensics and they're interviewing subjects and it's cool work. And they're sitting in a SOC and things are flying around. They're watching those bouncing balls going across the map, pinging back and forth.
Pew maps. Yeah. Pew, pew. Yeah,
the pew, pew maps. Right. I love that. Right. And then here's your compliance shop. And it's just this dreary idea of, oh, well, of course we have to do compliance. Of course, this notion of it's mandated and it's mundane and it's not fun. And what's the value? Like, we just have to do this so we can get a contract or we can pass an audit or we can pass an assessment and we can keep doing business. But it's not considered to be a strategic value generator. I mean, as much as we get a bad rap in security for not being a strategic value driver, compliance gets even the shorter end of that stick. And I think that's because we just haven't been doing compliance right. I think we allowed it to become what it is now for most environments. It's this paper-based process with a little bit of automation wrapped around it, but not really being seen as a real risk driver for the environment and forming real risk strategy decisions.
Well, and the other thing I tell people when I do that conversation around that truck is I remind them that business was trying to sell me a vehicle. Their goal was to pass that risk on to me without me noticing. And I mean, that is a very real thing that you do when you say, yep, we're compliant, and you haven't really done the real things that are necessary to make sure that there is the controls in place that would mitigate the risk. And then you do business with someone else. You're passing that problem on to them. And you're honestly just kind of hoping no one sees that there is an issue there.
That is an incredible thing that you just said. And I definitely want to highlight again for the audience, because I think there is a pool of dark risk that exists across the private industry and really any environment in the US and around the world. And when we look at things like the national critical infrastructure, that's, you know, 85% of it is in private hands. And compliance really is the only view we have into those. Now, of course, we've seen some executive orders come out recently, you know, 14028. We've seen OMB Memorandum 2131 saying we need to log better. We've got Memorandum 2209 now coming out, focusing on the national security infrastructure. There's a lot of stuff happening where we're trying to get a better, more proactive, more real-time look at the security posture and risk posture of these critical environments. But still, we're talking about a subset of a thing. And also, we're kind of looking through a keyhole, right? Compliance, a lot of times, is a keyhole. And also, it's pretty stale. By the time we get it, somebody has had a lot of hands in that process just to get that piece of data on somebody's dashboard or a report. You're lucky if it's a dashboard. Most likely, it's going to be a static report that you read 3 months after that piece of data was collected. And that's just not the operational tempo that we're dealing on the attacker side. That's the real problem. It's the time value. It's the time factor.
Well, it's a rolling horizon, you know, where your compliance is not going to be static, hopefully. Neither will the threat, which is a given, and neither will the technology or space that we operate in. So being able to say that you've cross some, you know, sort of arbitrary line in the sand, good. But guess what? 30 days from now, that line has just moved. So you must keep moving as well.
Yeah, I think bringing compliance onto the same pace, on the same cadence that we expect in security, it's a critical thing. And I think the fact is, if we're going to continue to rely on compliance as this overarching, all-encompassing function across all enterprises, and that's going to be the lens through which we look at risk, which is not a bad way, right? These standards, these frameworks, they didn't come out of thin air. They were created based on real experiences of risk and threats and real world attacks. You know, they come from NIST, they come from PCI, they come from everywhere. And there's a reason they're informed by real experiences. The problem is the implementation. When the rubber hits the road and you actually have the mandates come into an environment, you accept these inherent limitations within compliance programs, which are frankly based on manual processes with a little bit of automation wrapped around. And frankly, most compliance programs still live and die by spreadsheets and PowerPoints.
Yeah, until, I mean, that's, and I still, I mean, there's a few hills in cyber that I'm willing to die on, but and still, until you're willing to say your compliant environments had a red team go at it and go at it in a realistic manner, your compliance to me is, it's a Band-Aid on an artery.
Very, very true. Very true. Yeah, I think the concept that I'm talking about now a lot is the idea of convergence and really converging the functions, converging the data, and really understanding that there is no compliance data, there is no security data, there is no forensic data. It's all data. And if you think of things in terms of telemetry, and if you think also opportunistically, what do I have access to right now? What kind of data can I get visibility to? What decisions can it inform? And if it can't tell me anything on its own, that's fine. But what can it tell me when you correlate that data with other data? I mean, we're talking about the same ideas that we talked about 20 years ago, but you know, correlation and SIMS, and of course then Splunk came along. It's become a different thing, but the concepts are still the same. We want to get to the data that means something. We want to make sure we have access to those systems so we can mitigate and enforce some kind of a rule. We want to be able to block a threat in real time. We want to know about the threat in real time. We want to reduce our false positives, and we want to be able to do it at scale.
Yeah, and I think the one that I would throw into there that's probably the newest-ish sort of thing is we want to remind ourselves that technology by its very nature is inherently insecure. I mean, that's just the way anything that someone can build, someone has a way to break. And that's something that people should, you know, John talks about assume breach. Microsoft says it. I think that needs to be part of that common conversation of, you know, we, whatever we're using, it is compromised until proven otherwise. Oh, and guess what? Then it's compromised again until proven otherwise again. And it continues to go, you know, round and round in that cycle.
Yeah, I think we're getting to this idea slowly but surely. And now, unfortunately, we're out of time because the threats have proliferated so much, right? We have no non-proliferation strategy for the world of cyber, because once that tool is out, it's out. You know, we had the Vault 7 leaks, we had the other leaks. I mean, the tools are out there. And especially with the ransomware epidemic, any grandma in Ukraine can be in the ransomware business for a princely sum of $250. Yeah. And some have gotten into that business for exactly that much. I mean, we've seen, actually, I think in Russia, they caught somebody and she was, I think, 65 or 67 years old.
Yeah, it was a grandma. Yep.
It was an actual cyber grandma. So There you go. It's not that hard to get into that line of work. And the barrier to entry is non-existent. So everybody and anybody can be that. It's kind of like that scene in The Matrix when Neo was walking through the training simulator and the woman in the red dress turns around and turns out it's an agent. Yep, and Anybody can be, right? That's the problem that we're dealing with, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Very true.
So when we're in this highly saturated threat environment, zero trust seems to be a no-brainer. But how does one take that first step towards enabling zero trust in their environment?
Well, I mean, I've got studies to back it up. But the first thing you do is solve for identity and access management. I mean, I think that that's been something where folks were kind of hemming and hawing about it for a while. So I launched a survey in this, you know, late part of the summer of 21 and got the results back. And 80 something percent of folks said identity and access management first. And why? What is an adversary? Back to my original premise, right? What does a bad guy need to be successful? Lateral movement, they need privileges, et cetera. How do you get that? With usernames and accounts and access. So take care of that first. Everything else follows that. There's 100,000 ways to solve this problem, and there's a whole bunch of really useful technology that can help you do it, and a lot of different methods to solving it. But first order of business, remove that avenue of compromise, stop the threat where it originates, use identity access management.
You've heard it here first, guys. No, you haven't. You've heard it many, many times. But yeah, IAM is definitely the way to do it. Because look, in the end, anything that matters is going to have an identity component to it. And so will the attack pattern. So you've got to understand that. You've got a threat model for it. And again, talking about time value, right? If you can get there ahead of the threat, you can mimic the threat. You can emulate the threat. You can have a realistic attack run. You know, I'm not talking about scans. I'm not talking about static code scans. We're talking about real time, real life, very realistic, using true attack methodology. That's the only way to get it done. And that's the only way to know not only is your environment capable of withstanding an attack and remaining resilient, but also how is your team going to do when the real fire happens?
Bring the heat. I mean, you know, until you feel the heat, you don't know what it's like. So I'm speaking from personal experience, being inside of a building that was intentionally set on fire. If you're not ready for it, you will see things go sideways. So do it, make it real.
Very cool. Well, let's leave the audience with some parting thoughts. Wrap up. What do you want to leave folks with? If you were giving them one advice to live by as a CISO, as a security practitioner, what would it be?
That it's not about tech. It's not about cool, shiny, what's sexy, marketed, whatever. It's about the strategy that applies to your business, to your use cases. You apply it the way that you think makes the best use of what you have to solve the problem. And if you think that you can do quicker, better, faster with vendor solutions and technologies, then by all means, bring those in. But 100 times, 1,000 times over, security is about strategy. It should be a business enabler and benefit to the business and to the users. And anything that doesn't help with that is, counter to the actual solution that you're looking for.
That's perfect. Well, with that, we'll leave you. Thank you for joining us. Chase Cunningham, Dr. Zero Trust, Compliance Therapy.
Thank you much.
Thank you so much.